Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders. Insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what can nature teach us about how to build better societies? Then on the Scholar Circle, the effect of incivility and vilification on public policy, political participation, and the actual psychology of citizens. What can nature teach us about organizing our societies, governments, and businesses? Our next guest says a lot. The creatures in nature, he says, have been living and thriving in a risk-filled planet for billions of years and have survived some of the deadliest conditions by constantly adapting to the challenges, by decentralizing their responses, by cooperating with unlikely partners, and changing as a result. Rafe Sagran is a marine ecologist and environmental policy analyst, as well as a research scientist at the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona. He is also author of Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. It's great to have you with us, Rafe Sagran. Let's start with your fundamental premise, which seems to be that nature really has a lot of important lessons for us, no matter what kinds of things we're organizing in society.
Any situation where there's uncertainty and some kind of risk in the environment, which we all deal with, are areas where we can learn from natural evolution and adaptation, because that's what natural organisms are dealing with, 3.5 billion years of total uncertainty in a risk-filled world. So it can be national security, but it can also be how you're going to get your business through the next economic cycle, or how you're dealing with a group of at-risk kids in a classroom. It's really any time you have a situation that has a high degree of uncertainty.
Your prologue was so interesting, where you talk about the late December 2006 when the animals started to act really funny and they started running to higher ground and refusing to walk on the beach.
Yeah.
And then an hour later, we had that awful tsunami that killed 225,000 people. And you point out that the animal-based system worked where our man-made tsunami warning system failed.
Exactly. So animals basically are much better alarm systems than anything humans created. You just had an article that I commented on in the LA Times a couple days ago on the BioWatch alarm systems, which are billion-dollar alarm systems that are totally failing everywhere, giving lots of false alarms and creating all this uncertainty. But animal systems work because they have such an intensive observational sense of the world and how it changes and how it usually changes, and then they can pick up on these subtle changes far earlier than most humans.
Is this primarily keener senses? You've talked about observation and keen observation being really important.
Yeah.
But animals, of course, do have these keener senses. What is the explanation?
Well, in some cases, it's having keener senses. Some of them may have a magnetic sense, and they may have keener chemical senses, but it's also just the practice of observing makes you a better observer, and that's what my newer book, Observation and Ecology, which comes out this week, is about. It's about how the practice of continually observing complex systems like the natural world makes you a better observer and allows you essentially a predictive capacity. Although organisms don't really predict the future, you can essentially get a sense of what fits into a pattern and what doesn't fit into a pattern, and that allows you to exploit new opportunities. And you can see this in human athletes as well. The best human athletes, not coincidentally, also happen to be the ones that practice the most. So you would think, you know, someone like Michael Jordan or Wayne Gretzky would be done with practice because they're so good. Well, they're the ones who practice the longest, the hardest, and what they're doing is essentially training their brain to make predictions based on patterns.
This would go into the chapter you talk about learning and the different kinds of learning, and learning you call a force of nature, almost like gravity.
It is. It's impossible to be in the world and be observing the world, especially the way that wild organisms do, and not learn. And that's the real danger of spending so much time inside, spending so much time in front of our screens, is that we're learning in a much less complex world. There's just no way about it. A binary system like a computer is much less complex than a natural system, and you're essentially dulling down the learning process, which is why I talk a little bit in Learning from the Octopus and a lot in the book Observation and Ecology about how we've got to get our kids back out into nature and put the screens down and push them out there and let them solve their own problems out there.
Let's talk about some of these kinds of learning. One is this kind of interaction with the environment. One might be, you said, even encoded in DNA passed from, you use the mother sea otter to pup, and the kind of combined learning that is important and how that manifests in nature versus what we deal with as humans.
Yeah, exactly. So you get learning essentially just from passing down your genes. It's essentially intergenerational learning, and then you learn during your lifetime. Now, in both cases, in nature, I say that the most important learning, the learning that really gets you somewhere, is learning from your past successes. So every single organism in nature is an example genetically of learning from its ancestors' successes. But they also have to learn from their successes what things work, what tactics work, what behaviors worked, and replicate those during their lifetimes. We tend to do a lot of focus in society on learning from failure. So we focus intently on what we did wrong. We have all sorts of after-action reports and meetings in our business about everything we did wrong. And there's a lot in the business literature these days that suggests it's sort of clever to learn from your mistakes or learn from failures. And it sounds sort of self-effacing. But in fact, learning from failure in nature is the dead end. It means you die. It means you don't reproduce. Learning from success is the process of building on something that works and then building something even better off of that platform. And the example I give in the book, Hurricane Katrina, sure, there were a lot of failures that we wanted to learn from and not repeat. And I certainly don't say that we should ignore them. But in all the after-action report on Hurricane Katrina, which identified over 100 different failures, they didn't talk at all about the most important success, which was a Coast Guard containing 9 million gallons of oil spilled. And it turns out that that one success is exactly the one thing you needed to learn from for the next big Gulf disaster, which was the Deepwater Horizon. So by being so focused on the failures and having no focus on the successes, government missed a really good opportunity to learn from what it takes to clean up, in this case, oil in a logistically compromised situation.
One thing I was wondering as you were talking about and writing about learning from the ancestors is people who have gone through really traumatic things, say Holocaust survivors, genocide survivors, war survivors, do you think that their offspring learn something that is not necessarily adaptive to a society that's not at war?
No, I don't think so. I think that when you're surviving in completely novel, horrific situations, that's when your natural adaptive capacities really kick in. And by telling those stories, how did I survive this war? How did I survive through the Holocaust? You essentially provide a way for your offspring or people in your community to learn from those successes. That's why I give several stories of young officers and soldiers who have been fighting for 10 years now in Iraq and Afghanistan. These people are coming back. They have been incredibly adaptable in how they survived over there. And there's two things that we really need to focus on with this population. One is ensuring that they're healthy and that they're getting through the stress and physical abilities that they have. But the second is that everyone, if they own a business, if they're in government, if they're in a nonprofit, should be snapping up these young men and women because they are the brain trust of how to be adaptable in the world. They have incredible ideas and they have it sort of built into their system now of how to be adaptable. And they can use those skills in peacetime. They can use them in civilian jobs. So I say, you know, it's not just a patriotic duty to hire a veteran. It's really going to benefit your organization to bring these people in.
I'm going to want to go back to that whole idea of adaptability since that's one of the big focuses of your book. But before I do, I want to stick to the learning thing for a moment. There's also an idea among teachers about unlearning things that are bad, unlearning a bad habit, unlearning a mistake. Where does that come in? Because if you practice a bad behavior or a bad mistake, it just becomes part of your learning process.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just back east visiting my parents and driving up Route 8 in Connecticut, and a brought back to my childhood, where every time we drove up this complicated intersection on Route 8, my mom would take the wrong exit, and she would say, I know it's the wrong exit, every time I do it. And she just had it built into her brain to go off on the wrong lane. So I've been thinking about that, and certainly you can reinstill learning of bad habits, which is why you have to go back to this process of being keenly aware of your environment, because it's your environment and the changes that in your environment that sort of dictate what's going to work and what's not going to work there. So that's a way you sort of break out of that cycle.
So let's talk about some of these creatures that you look at, like the title of your book, Learning from the Octopus, that perhaps we can take guidance from the living world about how society can actually function and function well. One of the major issues is adaptability. And you talk about the octopus as a very important creature to watch and how it adapts. Give us some examples.
Yeah, the octopus is a great metaphor for how we can use adaptability, because the octopus demonstrates so many of the characters of adaptable systems as a whole. And surprisingly, the octopus is not that much different from us in the sense that it has a very good central brain or central controller. It has a cognitive mind, really, and a lot of people don't know that. But octopuses are smart, clever. They can create things. They can make and use tools. They think about the future. And yet, the octopus doesn't use that wonderful central brain when it really needs to adapt quickly. For example, if it needs to change color quickly, it doesn't have its brain yell to arm one turn purple, and then arm two turn green, and arm three turn kind of purplish blue. Rather, it has millions of individual skin cells spread all along its body that each individually respond to the changes that those skin cells perceive in the environment. And that as a whole, collectively, gives the octopus its camouflage. So the octopus has a brain which it can use, but it also shuts down that brain almost, or lets go of that central control in order for all those localized agents, all those individual skin cells, to respond and adapt to the environment. And that's a key metaphor, because a lot of the adaptable solutions I talk about require letting go of some of that central control, stopping the process of giving orders and switching to a process of issuing challenges, where you say, here's a problem we're facing. Anyone go out and solve this problem. And that activates all these individuals who can collectively come up with solutions that help us adapt. And you can do that kind of octopus-like camouflage or octopus-like problem solving in any kind of organization.
So it is an argument for decentralization.
It is. I suggest that it's, like I say, have an open mind, but not so open your brain falls out.
Right.
There's also a role for the central controller, but it may be different than what the role is right now that we see in a lot of organizations and a lot of businesses and a lot of governments.
I learned so much about the octopus from reading your book, and really wanted to hear you describe a little bit of the activities that it takes on. You mentioned that the tool building before, but there are all these other things about the ink that it can spray out, and then how it still can change one side of itself to attract a mate while changing the other side to warn others off.
Yeah, and this is another key theme that makes the octopus a great central metaphor, is it does so many different things to solve problems. And I talk about this as a process of creative redundancy that's also very common in nature. We tend to think of redundancy as wasteful or inefficient, but in fact, redundancy gives you multiple different ways of solving problems, because once again, you can't really predict what the next problem is going to be. So an octopus can jet away in a cloud of ink. It can camouflage itself. It can bite an enemy. It can squeeze itself into a tiny, tiny crevice. Once years ago, my old advisor, Chuck Baxter, when he got married in Monterey Bay, threw a wine bottle, a champagne bottle, over the boat that he got married on. And about 5 years later, he was diving and saw the same wine bottle with an octopus stuffed inside. So an octopus can squeeze itself through the neck of a wine bottle, which is quite amazing.
Could it get out?
Oh, yeah, sure. So it's incredibly flexible, and it has this great brain that I mentioned. So the octopus has been shown to utilize new things in its environments. There's an octopus video that shows an octopus has learned to take the halves of coconuts that tourists throw overboard in a South Pacific island, and it grabs them, takes them back to its lair, and later can use those two halves of a coconut and wrap itself up in them and use it as a kind of suit of armor.
So this was one of the examples of adaptability, which is what you argue we're missing in some of our human bureaucratic states.
We see it especially in businesses now. There's this endless pursuit of efficiency, and we think by getting rid of redundancy, often in the form of firing people, that we're going to become more efficient. But that misses the larger picture. We become less adaptable as we become less redundant in this way. I know a businessman who's very successful. He runs a manufacturing business, and he bases his whole business on biological principles. And one of the things he was proudest to show me was an entire warehouse he had of spare parts. And he said, none of my competitors would ever waste a whole warehouse on spare parts. They're all about just-in-time manufacturing, very efficient. And yet, when any one of my clients needs one of these parts, I'm the only one who has them. So I can charge anything for them, and I can, you know, mark up whatever I want, and then customers come back to me because they know I'm the only one who has what they need. So he's looking at the much bigger picture, even though it's inefficient to house all those spare parts.
The other, I thought, really key point in your book that you draw from nature again is the idea of symbiosis and cooperation. You said that it appears in nature even in the most unlikely situations. What are some of those?
The amazing thing about symbiosis is indeed that sometimes organisms that you think would have nothing to do with one another develop these partnerships. And there are examples everywhere in nature. For example, cleaner wrasses are small fish that clean the teeth of much larger predatory fish. And what's amazing that we're just learning now is that these symbiotic partnerships often have what we call emergent properties, or things that you wouldn't expect from the relationship of the two organisms. So we're learning now that these larger predatory fish are much less aggressive to all the fish in that reef patch when they're being cleaned by these cleaner wrasses. And we see that the most effective symbiotic partnerships in humans often come, again, between groups of humans or individuals that you would never expect to work together. And I talk in the book about a partnership of Israeli, Palestinian, and Jordanian health practitioners who are all working together to solve the problem of infectious diseases, no matter what side of whatever disputed territories they arise in. Now, one of the important things about this partnership is, and I talk about how natural systems do not aim for perfection. They just try to solve problems. These partnerships between the Israelis, Palestinians, and Jordanians are not trying to create peace in the Middle East. That is not their goal. They don't put that forward as their goal. They're trying to solve the immediate problem of infectious diseases. And by focusing intently on that immediate problem, they've created a very strong partnership. Now, that partnership may result in the first steps towards peace in the Middle East, but they don't put that as a goal. Just like natural organisms and natural systems do not have goals. They do not have a plan, a long-term plan. They're just trying to solve the challenges in the environment. So when you want to create a symbiotic partnership, first of all, it doesn't matter who you want to create it with. You could create it with anyone. But secondly, you want to look at what is the problem we can solve by working together, not, oh, it'd be a great idea for us to work together.
There were other aspects, too, like the evolution of some of these symbiotic relationships. They transform from one to another. You said some viruses start out parasitic, later become harmless.
Absolutely. That's another thing we're learning about symbiotic partnerships is that they can transform. And many symbiotic partnerships that are around today used to be conflictual relationships between organisms or competitive relationships.
And the other aspect I thought was really interesting and important in this is that things are always changing. The symbiosis is always changing. The environment is always changing. And that nothing is really going to stay the same.
all the good naturalists going back to Darwin recognize that change is another sort of force of nature, something that you just can't deny, that the world is always changing. And that's exactly at the core of why anyone needs to be adaptable, because whatever you do now may not be what you need to do to solve the problems of the future. And the problems of today may be totally different than the problems of tomorrow. And the only way to deal with that, because you can't predict every possible change that could occur in a complex world, the only way to deal with it is to become adaptable.
Now, you noted that one researcher, when he was looking at these kinds of relationships, he saw them decidedly pointing away from conflict and warfare.
This is an early naturalist and ecologist, people like Warder Ali, who was at the University of Chicago, and then his student, Ed Ricketts, who is pretty well known to people on the West Coast. He was a good friend of John Steinbeck's, and he appears in a number of Steinbeck's novels. These early naturalists really didn't see any difference between the natural world and human societies, and they thought that lessons could easily be transposed across from the natural world to society. And some of them were working in the period between wars, and they were trying to figure out what can we learn from nature about conflict and about getting rid of conflict. And one of the things, especially, that Ali was focused on was cooperation among organisms. And he felt that the natural tendency, not necessarily within an organism's lifetime, but through generations, the natural tendency was towards cooperation, that even relationships that were conflictual now would evolve into cooperative relationships, and that it was a continual cycle, that they would go back, there would be new conflicts that would arise, and those too would also ultimately transform into cooperative relationships. So it wasn't a one-way pathway by any means, it was a cycle. But it was a cycle that where cooperation continually trumped conflict.
Of course, you're a scientist, but you also worked in Congress. Did you talk about any of these things when you were in Congress, when you were working
there? No, it was actually my own adaptation and my own movement. I say that adaptation is about leaving or being forced from your comfort zone, and that happened to me. My comfort zone was always working in the tide pools of the Pacific Coast, but I found myself after 9/11 way outside of my comfort zone working as a science advisor to Congresswoman Hilda Solis, who's now the Labor Secretary in Washington, D.C. And it was my observations, essentially being a naturalist of the world of Washington, D.C., since I didn't have tide pools to look at, those observations led me to think about a better way to do security, because what I was seeing was security going up everywhere. I stole Mike Davis's title from his book about L.A., An Ecology of Fear, to describe Washington, D.C. after 9/11. It was an ecology of fear. There were new signs of security everywhere, but they always stayed the same. So new metal detectors everywhere, but the procedures never changed. And we learned very quickly, we adapted very quickly as staffers on the Hill to figure out how you get around these metal detectors so you didn't have to take your keys out of your pocket, things like that. And I thought, if staffers, to avoid a little inconvenience, can figure out how to get through these security systems, an adaptable organism like a terrorist certainly could figure that out. So that led me to start thinking about these things and thinking about all the ways that organisms adapt to deal with a changing environment.
And then two contentions I had with the argument, kind of challenges, not really contentions, I should say. One is, you suggest essentially that bureaucracies are not really changing. But I would argue that they are changing, even if they change slowly.
Certainly. I mean, everything changes, and bureaucracies can change. What I'm suggesting is not that we have to completely eliminate these bureaucracies, get rid of the Department of Homeland Security, and start over again. It's nice when you can create an adaptable system out of nothing, like Google was created as an adaptable company. But I show through examples of even some very traditional companies like 3M and very traditional bureaucracies like the Department of Defense that there are people working within those organizations and figuring out ways to be adaptable. So you can start creating adaptable systems anywhere. you don't have to take the whole thing down and rebuild it. Again, nature doesn't aim for or try to be perfect. You just have to solve the problems. And the way you do it is by starting to issue these challenges in any part of an organization. And I show how 3M, for example, did that brilliantly when they wanted to reduce their environmental footprint. They didn't have the CEO say, everyone recycle 20% more as an order. They issued a challenge and said, anyone in this organization who can help us reduce our environmental footprint, give us your ideas. And they had over 8,000 different successful ideas that were implemented that massively reduced their environmental footprint, saved the company millions and millions of dollars, and didn't cost the company anything. All people got for participating in this challenge was like a certificate of achievement. The remarkable thing about issuing challenges is that people will rise to the occasion. They are empowered and excited to help solve a problem, and it takes very little motivation, financially or otherwise. A little bit, but it always turns out to be much less than you would expect, and it always turns out to be much cheaper, and you get results much more quickly than the order-based mentality where an expert or a small group of experts tells everyone else what to do and expects them to follow it.
And then finally, as I was reading the book and I sat it down to just sort of think about it, I thought, well, there's so much that you are right about in terms of there's so much in the natural environment and the adaptability and things that we have sort of lost. And then at the same time, I thought human beings are the ones that are surviving the most of all the other creatures.
And we are an incredibly adaptable species. And in some ways, that has gotten us 99.9% of the way. But we're starting to see where all that adaptability that allowed us essentially to insulate ourselves from the daily struggle to survive, and I always put a caveat that there's still a billion people in this world who don't get enough to eat every day, which means that they are still in the tooth and claw world of surviving every day. But for the rest of us, we've insulated ourselves to some extent from the daily pressures, and that sort of dulled our adaptive senses, just as I talk about spending so much time in front of our screens and indoors is dulling our observational senses, which allow us to be adaptable. And so the book is really a call to get back a little bit of that adaptability that we used to have. And again, we see it where modern humans are put in situations of heavy stress, where they have to be adaptable, like the soldiers and Marines who have spent 10 years fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan have become very adaptable again.
So that old saying of if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger might be true.
Maybe, yeah.
Well, great. Thank you so much for being with us. The book, again, is called Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. And we've been speaking with Rafe Sagarin. Thank you so much, Rafe.
Thank you.
When we come back, the effects of incivility and vilification on public policy, political participation, and the psychology of citizens. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Politics in the U.S. have become increasingly hostile and uncivil in the past, say scholars. Language often vilifies fellow citizens and lawmakers. But Americans overwhelmingly dislike the incivility and have expressed shame at its effect on policy debates. What are the effects of incivility and vilification in a democratic society? Do they have real effects on the public policy? Does it affect political participation or the psychology? psychology of the citizens. We're joined by three experts. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs and professor of international affairs at the George Washington University. He is author of Projections of Power, Framing News, Public Opinion, and U.S. Foreign Policy, and Mediated Politics, Communication in the Future of Democracy. His upcoming book is Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Stephen Hayman is professor of law at Chicago Kent College of Law. He is the author of Free Speech and Human Dignity and the editor of Hate Speech in the Constitution. Michael Wagner is professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and he is the co-author of Political Behavior and Midterm Elections. He's also co-author of The Consequences of Political Vilification. Let's start with the old idea of deliberation. Michael Wagner, your literature review reminds us about the benefits of real deliberation on political issues and how all sides come out ahead. Give us the overview about what democratic deliberation offers when people communicate about their disagreements.
Democratic theorists have long extolled the need for quality debate and compromise among lawmakers. And so governance requires at least political elites to deliberate and work together in order to come to some kind of consensus. The question, of course, is what is the quality of that deliberation? And is there something about what happens when the quality of that deliberation changes that can affect basic democratic processes like compromise or support for compromise or the willingness for Americans to civically engage? And so with my co-authors, Beth Tice Morse and Donna Jean Mitchell, we think that there is. And we think that when rhetoric is particularly nasty, something we call vilification, it affects people's willingness to compromise, both in terms of individual citizens' willingness to accept compromise and possibly even lawmakers' willingness to compromise across partisan lines. And so that's kind of where we begin our analysis.
Is that just an ideal that we have never had? Robert Entman.
Well, it may well be that our image of the past tends to be golden and unrealistic. So I'm not sure for how many generations we had what we would now call civil as opposed to uncivil discourse. But I would say that probably the era that much of political science and democratic theory is based in is the 50s and 60s, and that was a time when there was a different tone in Washington, but not just a different tone, a respect for certain rules of the game, which includes pretty much telling the truth, pretty much actually desiring to solve policy problems. And those are two things that have gone by the wayside.
So you would say that it has deteriorated, it has become more uncivil, and it's not something that historically has always been there.
Correct.
Steve Hayman?
There's a deep ambivalence in our First Amendment on the subject that you're asking about. There's a very strong theme in the Supreme Court's decisions about the First Amendment protecting a meaningful dialogue of ideas, a give and take between citizens where each of us has the right and the duty to express our own views, to listen to the views of other people, to try to understand where they're coming from. So that's one central image of the First Amendment. But at the same time, there's also sort of a different view that the First Amendment is meant to protect speech that may be abrasive, that may be sharply critical of public officials or of other groups within the society, and that the First Amendment almost exists to protect offensive speech because it is uncivil or because it challenges existing conventions.
I definitely want to get into the legal issues a little bit more nuance in a bit. Perhaps we should discuss the concepts of what it means to have incivility. Bob, you said there are two kinds of incivility. What do you mean?
The kind of incivility we always talk about tends to be the impoliteness and kind of nasty rhetoric and personal insult. And that's important, and it's troubling when we have that kind of incivility. But the Oxford English Dictionary has a second definition, and I think that's actually our bigger problem now. And the second definition is orderly state of a country, social order as distinct from anarchy and disorder. And what I believe is that not that we're in a state of anarchy, but we're in a state in which we have disordered politics and disordered governance. And that's the real problem. And it comes down to the tendency of certain political actors to disregard what had been a longstanding norm of telling the truth and not deliberately making things up and sticking to those points if they win you political power.
You
an example, climate change.
You talked about this, that this was a party strategy to keep winning. Can you explain how you find this strategy and what the reaction has been from the other party?
The strategy is actually to create this disorder and to create bad governance, because that's a way to discourage people from believing that government can solve problems and to encourage them to support so-called smaller government. And if you do that, in some senses, it doesn't really matter if that's your real goal, that is keeping power and shrinking the size of government and shrinking what government does, then it doesn't really matter what you're saying specifically, because that's the simple goal and that's the simple target. And from the point of view of the other party, it becomes very difficult to conduct a civilized dialogue from either side if one of the sides is really refusing to acknowledge some facts that most everyone who is intellectually honest would agree are indeed factual. So, you know, my main point is that we really have to name this problem more carefully. And it is a problem of the Republican Party having decided on this strategy, having moved sharply to the right, the Democratic Party trying to induce compromise on the part of the Republicans, and the Republicans responding by really not having any incentive or inclination to compromise in the interest of solving the problem. The real interest is shrinking the government and actually maintaining and expanding their power. That's an unfortunate thing. I know it sounds like I'm being partisan when I identify the problem as that, but I believe that's where we are, and I believe it's important to name the problem as it is so we can maybe do something about it.
This is one form of incivility. Michael Wagner, you study political vilification of the other side. How do you distinguish the vilification from these other kinds of incivility?
I think Bob did a good job defining the kind of incivility that he wishes we would focus less on when he was describing, you know, kind of impoliteness, name-calling, derision of the opponent, those sorts of things, as being something that's uncivil with respect to discourse in American politics. And incivility has some effects on how people respond to political debate when they see it amongst political elites. What my colleagues and I want to argue is that there's something that we call vilification, which we make the argument that that's different than incivility. And so our argument is that incivility comprises name-calling, derision of the opponent, you know, impoliteness, things of that nature. And vilification calls the other side evil, malevolent, ungenuine, bent on destroying the country. So they ascribe a particular motive. It's not just that the other side are jerks. It's not just that the other side won't agree on the facts. It's that they're evil. It's that they're dangerous. And our argument is that when people are exposed to that kind of rhetoric, it makes some people way less likely to want to compromise, and it makes others way more likely to want to compromise. And much in the way that Bob makes the argument that the Republican Party has adopted a particular strategy, we make the argument that Republicans and Democrats in the electorate respond differently to vilification. So when Republicans see their party vilified, we find that they know who the enemy is, and there's no way they're going to compromise with them. If they come out and call us evil and dangerous, we're never going to make a political agreement with those folks, and we wouldn't support our leaders if they did. We find that Democrats in the electorate, when they see their party vilified, when they see their party called evil and dangerous, they become much more supportive of compromise. They want the fighting to stop. They want to come to some kind of solution as compared to keeping the attacks going. And so this has real implications for how governance works, because if you were the Democratic Party, you might not get much purchase out of attacking the other side in this particular way, because it's going to entrench your opponents and it's going to make your side want to compromise. And so, you know, there's some linkages, I think, with what Bob is talking about in terms of why the politics of today are the way that they are. What we don't know is how this has really varied over time. And so that's something that we're trying to investigate. That takes a really long time. And so I can't speak to whether the language is specifically worse now than it used to be. But I think our data does suggest that people in the electorate respond differently to vilifying attacks. And they don't respond that way just when the attacks are uncivil or when the facts or the attacks are based on factual disputes. People don't have those same reactions in terms of their support of compromise or supporting other kinds of democratic principles.
I think I want to quickly talk about one more layer. There's one more level of this incivility vilification, and that is, hate speech and harmful speech that is actually a legal issue. And Steve Hayman, this is where we bring you in. What distinguishes harmful speech and hate speech from other kinds of political speech?
You could view hate speech as being the most extreme form of the kind of speech that Bob and Mike were just talking about. That is, if you go one step even beyond vilification, beyond accusing your political opponents of being evil, if you go so far as to actually dehumanize them, to treat them as though they were subhuman, as though they're not entitled to the respect that you would give to other human beings or citizens. And in particular, if you abuse and degrade other people on the basis of their race or their ethnicity or their religion or their gender or their sexual orientation, that's what I would regard as being hate speech.
What if they were degraded with regards to their political ideology? Now, so far, we don't have that as a legal category. But one of the things that we have seen change in American discourse as the ultra-right airwaves have emerged is that liberals have been called all of these kind of dehumanized names. But we haven't seen that emerge yet in the legal world.
That's right. And I think the reason for that is that the Supreme Court regards the right to sharply disagree about political issues to be right at the core of the First Amendment. And so to the extent that people are attacking other members of the polity on the basis of their political views, I think the tendency is more to view that as being a vigorous or sharp political disagreement rather than an actual denigration of the very humanity of the people that you're disagreeing with.
Some of the dialogue does get to the level of calling liberals a scourge of society. How does that comport?
I agree with you that it's possible for political rhetoric to become so extreme as to amount to a sort of hate speech against your political opponents. And I think that we need to try to avoid that to the greatest extent possible and to condemn it when people do engage in that kind of speech. I should add that existing First Amendment jurisprudence treats even racist hate speech as generally being protected by the First Amendment. All the more so, I think, the court would regard the kind of political hate speech that you're talking about as protected.
So there's a wide range of potential consequences. Robert Entman, you pointed out that there are some serious policy implications. One you mentioned was climate change. Another is how Obama approached the war out of his fear of being attacked.
This very much goes along with what Michael was talking about, in that it is rational for Obama to anticipate that if he were to make any move such as, for example, sharply de-escalating the war in Afghanistan, any move that would put him up to the charge of being unpatriotic or soft on defense, that the Republican Party would take that opening and run with it, and it would actually go along with the frame that they've already been pushing about he wasn't really born in the United States and he's a socialist and he's an anti-colonialist and so forth. And I believe that there's substantial evidence, for example, in Bob Woodward's book about Obama's war, that the reason we are still in Afghanistan, the reason we have not curtailed and brought that to a close the way we are doing apparently in Iraq, is because of that fear that we're in Afghanistan because of the kinds of incivility that we're talking about right now.
The climate change issue you started to talk about, media have had a profound impact on this. Bob Entman?
In the case of climate change, you have a situation now where all but one of the Republican candidates for the United States Senate in 2010 denied that climate change is a problem, and that one doesn't want to do anything about it. So we're talking about now a situation not contemplated by Democratic theory, as far as I know, at least in the American context, and that is where one party, for whatever reasons, is unified around something clearly not factual, and clearly there is climate change, and no reputable scientists dispute that to any substantial degree. And if you have that situation, you have a paralyzed policy process, because our particular political process is one that gives minorities, like such as the Republican minority in the Senate, an opportunity to veto pretty much anything that they don't like. And that's what's happened here. So think about this. We really haven't had much in the way of any discussion at all about climate change during the Obama administration. There was a little bit around the Copenhagen conference, but that's it. And this is a huge issue facing the whole world. So now we're talking about our incivility actually affecting not just America, but the globe.
And there was an additional incivility, which was after they hacked into the scientists' email accounts, they really vilified the scientists, which turned a lot of the public against science itself. At least the polls have shown that.
I think that's right, and I think that that can have a chilling effect on how scientists think about reporting their results, which is something that we ought to worry about, I think, as a democratic society. For example, thinking about climate change, another reason that this kind of rhetoric is allowed to exist is because in this particular role, the news media don't tend to act as an appropriate watchdog, which is to say it's kind of an accepted practice in journalism, regardless of whether a story has 1, 2, or 12 sides, to report two sides of a story. And so scientist X says that there's climate change, scientist Y says that there isn't, you decide, and if I report a story that way, then you can't call me biased. If I report almost all scientists who study weather and geography and climate and any variety of those sorts of things conclude that climate change is occurring, that it's accelerated since humans have developed particular technologies, and a couple of folks say that it hasn't occurred, then they open themselves up to charges of being biased, while at the same time would open themselves up to charges of telling the precise truth. But since reporters don't like to adjudicate between competing opinions, it's difficult to disabuse people of beliefs that they have that are false. I think that's all tied up into the style of rhetoric that we've been discussing.
Media have become very bifurcated, where you still have the media that try to do this objective, in quotes, reporting with two sides, but we've also seen this emergence of very one-sided, vilifying kind of media that has added to all of this. Canada and other countries have some restrictions on lying on the air. How is this addressed, and how should it be addressed?
The American Supreme Court has taken a much more absolutist approach to the protection of freedom of speech than many other liberal democratic countries do. And that's true with regard to hate speech and also true with regard to defamation and, as you said, other forms of lying on the air. And I think that in part it's simply because the First Amendment sounds more absolutist than the corresponding protections for freedom of expression in many other countries. In many other countries, there are explicit constitutional provisions that say that all of the rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution are subject to such limits as are justified in a democratic society. And in general, there's much more of a tendency in these other legal systems to strike a balance between freedom of expression on one hand and other strong public values on the other side.
One of your papers argues that there are other competing rights of citizenship, rights of intellectual freedom, rights of equality, that actually clash with this kind of public discourse. How would you express these nuances?
Particularly in the case of the racist hate speech that we had touched on before, that while I have a right to freedom of speech, that right is grounded in a respect for human dignity and autonomy, and that those same values give rise to other kinds of rights. A right to be free from violence, a right to citizenship and equality and reputation and so forth. In fact, if you go back to the original understanding of the First Amendment, the view was that the right to free speech was an inherent natural right, but it was limited by the rights of other people. I think that the modern Supreme Court has very much lost sight of that view, but that it would very much improve our First Amendment jurisprudence and then maybe in turn improve the quality of our public discourse if we would go back to a view that sees free speech as limited by the rights of other people.
Here's an irony, if I may say, in that the uncivil politics of Supreme Court nominations directly affects the ability of the Supreme Court, or let's say the inclination of the Supreme Court, to take a more nuanced view of the First Amendment. So we used to have a view on the Supreme Court that was a more balanced one between rights of free speech and rights of citizens and so forth. And that view has been pushed aside to a small minority now and an absolutist version of the First Amendment ensconced, precisely because the Republican Party absolutely refuses to consider liberal justices. So all we've had is very conservative justices nominated by Republican presidents and very moderate centrist justices nominated by Democratic presidents, because those are the only ones that Republicans would allow to go through. So I think it's really important for listeners to understand that the First Amendment has the meaning of it has changed in practice over time, and that's very much dependent on the identity of the Supreme Court. And because the parties are so polarized, and in particular the Republican Party is so determined to hold on to power, that it actually affects the way the First Amendment operates in our country at any given time.
Steve Heyman, would you like to add to that?
It has changed, and one very interesting and dramatic change that's taken place over the past 30 or 40 years is that freedom of speech, which used to be primarily viewed as a liberal or a progressive value, has come to be appropriated by the right. So it is now conservatives who tend to be much more absolutist, at least within the Supreme Court, on First Amendment issues than the liberals do. And I think there's a view on the part of the conservative justices that any sort of even reasonable or moderate restrictions on hate speech or on corporate speech is some sort of an effort on the part of the left to suppress conservatives. So that helps to explain why it's the conservatives who have been most absolutist in the protection of hate speech and the conservatives who were responsible for the Citizens United decision.
Michael Wagner, let's bring you back in.
It occurs to me that we see some of these same principles and same, I guess not really principles, tendencies coming into other elements of our politics. And so Bob had made an argument that Republicans nominate extreme Supreme Court justices and Democrats nominate moderate ones. And if we look at the results of the 2010 congressional elections, we find something similar in that there's good evidence that the Republicans who won office for the first time in 2010 are more conservative than the Republicans who were already in office. The Democrats who won office for the first time in 2010 were more conservative than the Democrats who were already in office. And so Democrats who won were ideologically to the right of the Democrats in Congress, just as Republicans who won were ideologically to the right of the Republicans in Congress. And so there seems to be an acceptance amongst candidates for office about who they want to appeal to and how they want to appeal to them. And that, you know, is all wrapped up in the civility of our discourse, how people respond to that kind of rhetoric, how the media report that kind of rhetoric, and how courts allow or don't allow it. And so I think it all telling a similar story, which I think is something for us to really think about.
Where could this go from here into a more civilized discourse? Bob Entman, what are your thoughts? How do we move into more constructive dialogue?
That's an enormously important question. It may sound hard to believe, but it seems to me that we're reaching a point in this country where we need to start thinking of ourselves as having a form of civil conflict. It's not a civil war, but a lot of similarities between now and the pre-Civil War United States of the 1850s are going on. And we do know a lot more, I think, than we did then about how to bring groups that are unalterably opposed together and actually try to gain some common ground on the basis of mutual respect and understanding. So I would propose that we actually have conferences, a series of conferences, where the two sides sit down, and maybe they're not just politicians, but there are other people like professors, for example, in the room, and try to hammer this out in a way that recognizes that this is a little bit verging on going towards just the edge of a situation like Northern Ireland, or we could name many other civil conflicts. So we really need to take it very seriously. I do think that there's a little tendency on the part of Republicans in particular to see this kind of as a game. And at some point, this game becomes pretty dangerous. And that's why I think we ought to name this problem and take it seriously and really try to get both parties to understand that ultimately the stakes are the history, the future of our country and our children. And we really need to step back from where we've been lately.
Steve Heyman.
I would love to see the sort of effort to develop common ground that Bob was just talking about. I may be a little more pessimistic about the ability to do that. My sense is that a lot of the source of the incivility in our current politics comes from the refusal of a certain group of white conservative Americans to accept the very legitimacy of people who aren't like them, racial minorities, Barack Obama being the most prominent example, and that a lot of the incivility in the last 3 years has resulted from just a very powerful backlash against the very idea of having somebody like that in the White House, which goes along with the sort of vilification of liberals that we've been talking about. And Obama has done everything that he can over the past 3 years to try to develop that kind of common ground and civil discourse, and it really hasn't succeeded. So I guess my sense is that the first thing that we may have to do is actually to be a little bit more uncivil on the left, in the sense of coming out and very strongly condemning the kind of rejectionist, condemnatory views that we sometimes hear from the right, and that ultimately the best hope for establishing some kind of broader civility is when people who don't fall within the demographic that the Republican Party is appealing to can actually assert enough majority control over the society. The white conservative group recognizes itself as being part of a multicultural and pluralistic and ideologically diverse country, rather than taking the view that their country is being stolen from them and that they essentially do need to start a civil war against their opponent.
I think a couple things are going on here, and I think one is that, as Stephen talked a lot about what elites can do, I think just thinking about the public, one thing that's important to realize is that people are different. Individuals vary, and they do so systematically and in some cases intractably. And so to know that some people, honest to goodness, no matter what you tell them, believe that smaller government is good, and others believe that a more activist government is good, you know, these folks are not likely to change their views on that in a lot of cases. And so it's one way we can promote tolerance is to accept that people do have different views. And one problem with the American people is they drastically overestimate the degree to which people agree with them. And there's actually quite a bit of ideological diversity in the United States. And so I think recognizing that and promoting those differences would go some way toward improving tolerance, which I think could help the problem of uncivility. The second thing is that some recent research from a guy named Brendan Nyhan suggests that a great strategy at the elite level and at the public level to get people to believe things that are true when they don't want to is a strategy of naming and shaming. And so when President Obama said in the recent State of the Union, if you say things that aren't true about this policy, I'm going to call you out, that's the right strategy. He just hasn't done it. So political leaders need, and the news media need to say, you know, this person said something, it was not true. And every time they say it, they need to say it was not true. And so we need more things like PolitiFact, which won a Pulitzer Prize for, you know, kind of rating the truthfulness of what it is our lawmakers say. And, you know, while PolitiFact is an imperfect tool, it's the kind of tool that I think can promote the other kind of incivility that Bob was talking about at the top of our program, that, you know, the right to accept things that are true and they're true and the ability to believe them as fact and to stop rejecting facts for ideological reasons rather than empirically scientific ones.
That's a great place to end. Thank you also very much, Robert Entman, Professor of Media and Public Affairs and International Affairs at George Washington University, author of Projections of Power and Mediated Politics, Stephen Hyman, Professor of Law at Chicago Kent College of Law, author of Free Speech and Human Dignity and Hate Speech in the Constitution, Michael Wagner, Professor of Political Science at University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and co-author of Political Behavior in Midterm Elections and the Consequences of Political Vilification. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. And to Ankina Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Ishmael Karim, Carson Dezuris, and Aram Sasunian, who all contributed to today's show. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.